Well, good morning, everyone. I'm sure you all know who I am by now, but I'm Rich Walitsky, and it's been an honor to be one of the co-chairs that worked to put the conference together this year. So, what did you all think? Did we do good? All right. So, before we begin our final panel of the conference, I was asked to share just some thoughts, some reflections about my own experience at the conference. And I have to say, my first emotions were ones of joy and relief. When we started planning this conference, we weren't sure how many people were really going to come. We knew budgets were tight, travel restrictions were in place in a lot of organizations. But this conference, we had 300 more people attend than we had in 2009. We had, and what was particularly great is that we had so many young people here who took part in the conference this year. So I felt a little joy, a little relief. But I have to be honest, I also felt some anger and some frustration. I was angry that there's still so many new HIV infections that are taking place in this country, that we have 130 people in the United States who get HIV each and every day. I was angry that we still have 33 people a day with AIDS who die. I was angry that we have a 48% increase in the number of new HIV infections among young black men who have sex with men. And I was angry to see again and again so much data showing the persistence of long-standing disparities experienced by women of color, gay and bisexual men of all races and ethnicities, by people who use injection drugs, by the poor, by the homeless, and by trans people who are still fighting to be counted and to be recognized for the people they truly are. I also felt some frustration. I was frustrated that some people support social justice and some people support social change when it benefits them. But when it comes to social justice and social change for everyone, some people are too quick to ask others to wait just a little longer, to step back and wait their turn. Social justice, social equity is for everyone, and the time is now. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm just angry, bitter, and frustrated. I also saw some incredible signs of hope at the conference. There were so many sessions at the conference that focused on solutions, that focused on how people had developed innovative ways to overcome barriers, to fight injustice, and to demonstrate and effect positive change in the communities that they served. We saw evaluations of great programs that demonstrated significant positive effects. We saw the modeling that Dr. Holtgrave presented and models that were presented in other sessions that showed us how we can do better with the resources we have and how we can have a greater impact on the HIV epidemic today. We heard about new behavioral tools. We heard about new biomedical tools That's exciting. That holds tremendous promise for the future if we use these tools wisely. We heard about treatment and prevention. We heard about PrEP. But I think we have to temper that excitement and those expectations with a little dose of reality. We need to learn how to use these tools wisely, and we have to recognize that we don't have the resources to make them available to all the people who need them. And when we talk about not having enough resources, it's not just about there not being enough money being spent by the federal government or by state governments or by local governments. The other part of the equation is the cost. We aren't going to have the resources to be able to afford HIV treatment for everyone who needs it and to afford PrEP for everyone who can benefit from it at the current costs that the medications are at. I took a tremendous amount of heart and warmth and encouragement out of Paul Kawada's words that people living with HIV may be the solution to the end of the HIV epidemic. But I think people living with HIV are not going to be the solution just by going on HIV treatment. People living with HIV are going to be the solution by fulfilling our responsibility to make sure that our HIV stops with us, by fulfilling our responsibility to be leaders in our communities and to show the way forward. I felt a tremendous amount of gratitude and a tremendous amount of respect at this meeting for the leaders who were with us, who were there at the very beginning of the HIV epidemic. And I felt a tremendous amount of gratitude and respect for the leaders of today who were here and those of you who will be the leaders of the future. I was energized to see a little bit more of that old school activism and to see people get their act up back. The urgency is now. The time is now. If we're going to achieve the goals of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy by 2015, we're already behind, and we have to get our behinds in gear. So reaching the goals of the National Strategy depends upon all of us, and I'm really excited that we're going to be able to end the conference this time around, hearing from a panel of leaders who represent the community. And to moderate that panel, I'm especially pleased to be able to introduce someone who's been a colleague and a friend for many years, Dr. Ron Valdeseri. Dr. Valdeseri serves as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health, Infectious Diseases at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Valdeseri guides the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. The strategy is a priority endeavor for the U.S. government, and the President released his fiscal 2012 budget proposal for this year. He proposed a special fund to support the implementation of the strategy. Prior to joining CDC in 1989, Dr. Valdeseri was director of the Falk Clinic Laboratories at the University of Pittsburgh. He held academic appointments in both the School of Medicine and the Graduate School of Public Health. So join me in welcoming Dr. Valdeseri.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I just want to very briefly introduce our panel members. As Rich noted, we have three very distinguished and knowledgeable panelists, and I know in many instances from personal experience that probably each one of these panelists could keep us stimulated for 45 minutes each with conversation. But what I've been told by the conference organizers is that they're asking that each of the panelists try to keep their comments to about 5 to 7 minutes, because we do want to make sure that we end on time and have an opportunity to get everyone off safely. So just very, very briefly, we will first hear from Ms. Michelle Lopez, who is chair of the board of directors at the National Association of People with AIDS. She is a woman living with HIV, and she works as the treatment administrator for the Community Healthcare Network in New York City. I'm going to go ahead and introduce all of the panelists before I ask Michelle to take the podium. We will next hear from Mr. Phil Wilson, who is the founder and executive director of the Black AIDS Institute, and as I think many of us in the audience know, has a very long and distinguished career of activism and community service around HIV/AIDS issues. And then finally, we're very excited to have Dr. Marjorie Hill, who is the chief executive officer of the Gay Men's Health Crisis. And I think, again, us old folk know this, but for the young people in the audience, GMHC is the nation's oldest AIDS service organization. It's up there, and it's gone through many, many positive changes throughout its evolution. But that was its founding title, and that remains its title, GMHC, reflecting what was happening in the earliest days of the epidemic. So we're going to hear from each three of these distinguished panelists who are going to share their perspectives about advocacy and activism. I know that they're going to inspire and stimulate us, and we're going to begin by asking Ms. Lopez to share with us.
Buenos tardes, your familia. I stand here first and foremost giving honor and glory to the God of my life, because without him, I continue to say it is part of my journey and his blessing that has kept me here for the last 22 years living with this virus. I would be amiss if I do not give my sincere thanks and gratitude for my federal families, and I'm saying federal, governmental families, but in all fairness, it's families from my heart that I met throughout my journey. Maria Alvarez, God continue to bless you. Angel Ortiz, my brother, I love you sincerely. Alberto Santana, thank you again for believing in me. And Julio Descent, I think you of all and everyone can say, you know what, this sister, I got her back. So I love you guys. Thank you again for you continuing to believe and trust in me. I come from the state of New York, and as I stand here, I am, yes, a proud staff of Community Healthcare Network, but I have to say my journey, and as I talk and address what we look at achieving the national AIDS strategy and its goal, I want to definitely give credit and thanks that this is a federally qualified health center 20 years ago that gave an opportunity to a young woman who was severely battered, homeless, an undocumented immigrant, newly being diagnosed with HIV, and getting the diagnosis of your newborn baby, knowing that there was information provided to me that she was not going to seroconvert, that she is infected. She also, too, is good and well and alive today, 21 years living with HIV. My talk today is to give you a perspective and understand, again, when we talk about the involvement and us achieving the goals of the National AIDS Strategy, I'm going to be addressing the impact of this disease, yes, but I have to say first and foremost, again, I stand here as a Moreno Latina. This is who I am. This is how I was raised by my parents, sharing this child of two cultures that came together, my dad being of Venezuelan and my mom being Trinidadian. I have to say again, Trinidad and Venezuela engage in wonderful, wonderful marriages. I'm going to say that. I was raised also with the notion as a Caribbean Latina that I must accept my indigenous ancestors and my African heritage. So thank you for my sisters in the African American community who have always welcomed me working with them. First and foremost, I stand here as a woman living with HIV. Secondly, culture shaped my life to be very submissive to the many trauma that I experienced as a young girl growing up in the Caribbean. At the tender age of 6 until I was 11 years old, I was sexually molested by my 3 godbrothers in a household where my parents had separated, a critical point in a child's life. Dr. Wyatt, I take my hat off to you because you did diligence for us women and explaining to society, and the work still needs to continue on the impact of trauma and what it has done to women who are living with HIV today. The Latino community still continues to have a miscrew, and I am saying this because I tend to participate. Kaiser Foundation has done a tremendous amount of work talking about HIV and Latinos, but I can say 1 in every 10 Latino right now, presently as I speak here, do not understand why they're the ones that are being diagnosed with HIV when their 9 other counterparts, because it's 1 out of 10 have accepted and have gone forward and have gotten tested. But the other 9% of my Latino community does not think that HIV is a priority in our community. I am doing some work right now trying to work with a news media called Impacto so that this information needs to get out there. I am seeing the mobilization going on within the African American MSM community, with my black brothers and sisters, but I'm yet to see the leveling of the playing field of what CDC has done today to include this Latina woman to stand here living with HIV, to be part of a leadership panel. I share this podium with honor. Phil Wilson, Marjorie Hill, you know, and as we go on, these are individuals who have seen me grown up, and I'm going to say that I stand here at 45 years old, yes, but they have seen me grown up because my growth is not just because of my age, but because of behaviors and because of things that I have learned throughout my journey. Third, I stand here as a woman, and each and every one of us have to be accountable to our mission in life. And I'm going to ask everyone who has this pink slip that is sitting on your seat, this is an action. This is a call. Because the work that we are seeing done right now for the MSM population, we know what the outcome will be. They are mobilizing. They are strategizing. They are identifying the resource with whatever means possible. Women must be counted in. I ask you to stand with me. Can I depend on you to count women in? Can I depend on you to count women in? Can I depend on you, Dr. Fenton, your leadership and your demonstration? You have opened the doorway. Continue to work. Continue to fight. Thank you for your time and your dedication today. I want to thank CDC. My closing remark, I have to give diligence to CDC for their continued work on prevention with positives. We are mobilizing right now and we are organizing ourselves because of HPTN 052, but we have to be cautious, we have to be careful, and as my daughter continues to echo in my ear, do not forget la familia, because how we do our work is under the concept, and we need to be able to say, as a positive woman, to the negative woman, as a Latina, mujeres como tú. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very, very much, Michelle, for those very heartfelt and inspiring words. As I mentioned, our next presenter is going to be Mr. Phil Wilson. Phil, we look forward to your comments.
Thank you, Ron. I was asked to come and give a perspective about the 30 years of the AIDS epidemic. The Black AIDS Institute just released our report, 30 Years is Enough, the History of the AIDS Epidemic in Black America. And so I've been thinking about that a lot. And one of the advantages of getting old is that you have the opportunity to have been there, and you have an opportunity to reflect on those times. I was born in 1956. On the south side of Chicago. I came out in April of 1980. I was 23 years old. I fell in love with a man named Chris Brownlee and had my first same-gender sexual encounter. And probably I was infected that day. I have been living with HIV for just about my entire adult life. I've lived with HIV for so long that I don't remember what it was like not to live with HIV. I personify what it means when people with HIV have the love and support of family and friends and the care that we need and deserve. And today, as we think about 30 years of this epidemic, and as we are at a deciding moment, I think it is important to look back on the lessons learned. You know, what was it about those early days that allowed us to survive? You know, during the days when there was not government support, when we had a president that would not even mention the word AIDS, during the days when there was not industry support, during the days when foundations were not interested in this issue, we had something that was very, very important. We had each other. We understood, as Michelle said, that we were a family. I tell a story about when I was 10 years old and I discovered that my friends got an allowance and I didn't get an allowance. And so I called a family meeting with my two brothers and my sisters. And we sat down in our living room on the south side of Chicago in the housing projects of Allgell Gardens. And we made our case. And I explained to my parents that we deserved an allowance. I did homework like my friends Victor and Donald did. I got better grades than they did. And I should have an allowance. And we laid out how much the allowance should be. And of course, because I was the older of the four of us, that I got the larger allowance. And after I finished, my parents thanked us. And my mother stood up and she said, "No, that was a good presentation." And she said that, you know, we are a family. And in a family, everyone has to do their part. That's the only way that a family can survive. And it's important for us to understand that we are our family. You know, we're a human family. You know, and with communications and transportation and technology, every day our family gets closer and closer and closer together. And the only way that our human family can survive is that each and every one of us does our part. And while we could not necessarily keep our family members in the early days alive, we could say that Under my watch, you will not go on this journey alone. Under my watch, there will be someone there with you. And even though we did not have the answers, we were not willing to wait for someone else to come in and rescue us. In December of 1989, almost 10 years after we met, Chris Brownlee died. November of that year, he wrote a poem about living with HIV. And I'd like to share a segment of that poem with you this morning. It is a whimper. It is a scream. It is the brush of a branch on the screen of your window. A rustle, a rattle. It is being in your center and being so far from your center that you don't know if you'll ever find your way back. It is caring for your friends in ways you never have before. Intimate ways, horrible ways, ways that take more of your love than you knew you had. It's being there when the coma comes and begging in your heart for some little piece of mercy. It's fighting back. It's building of places to care for the living and for the dying. It's bearing the unbearable, enduring the endurable, and hoping in the face of hopelessness. It is courage. It is honor. It is integrity. It's people joining forces in a time of great need. It is hope. It is sharing the burden. It is people caring for their own and finding love and surviving and believing in the future even when we are hurting more than we have ever hurt before. It is AIDS. So as we go, as we go forward, I think it is important for us to be mindful that in HIV and AIDS, now the government has never led the way. There's a role for government to play. Now there's a role for the CDC to play. There's a role for HRSA and SAMHSA and all the federal agencies to play, but they have not led the way. Industry, pharmaceuticals have not led the way. Foundations have not led the way. Now, in the history of this epidemic, when it is told, the story will be that the people led the way, and we should never forget that. We are at a deciding moment. We are at a place where we determine whether or not we are ready to end this AIDS epidemic, or are we ready or willing to allow our brothers, our sisters, our mothers, our fathers, our sisters, our sons, our daughters continue to suffer from this disease. We have the tools to end the AIDS epidemic. That question has been asked and answered. The question is not, can we end the AIDS epidemic? The question is, will we end the AIDS epidemic? We have the tools to diagnose the disease. We have the technology to do testing. The diagnostic tools are getting better every day. There's no reason why each and every person does not know or cannot know their HIV status. We can identify where the epidemic is. We just saw a presentation on mapping. In some cases, all the way down to the zip code, or the census block. We can identify where the epidemic is. We can prevent exposure. And before we even get into new biomedical technology, there's old technology that allows us to prevent exposure. We know about condoms, we know about dental dams, we know about abstinence, we know about clean needles, we know about other barrier methods that we can prevent exposure from the disease. We can treat. Now, treatments are getting better every single day. Now, granted, treatments are not going to work for everyone. But for many of us, there are treatments available, and too many of us who should be on treatment are not. We know how to interrupt acquisition. Now, using PrEP, using vaginal microbicides. And we know how to interrupt transmission using treatment as prevention. So we have the tools to end the AIDS epidemic. Now, there's lots of work to be done, don't get me wrong. But we have to do that work. But one of the things we have to stop doing is having this ridiculous debate between whether or not we should do prevention or treatment. We should not be having the debate on whether or not we should be doing PrEP or treatment. When nobody else gave a rat's ass, when there was no money, when there was no drugs, we said, make it happen. That's our power. We should not give that away. We can do all of it, and we must demand to do all of it, and we should not drink the Kool-Aid coming out of Washington, D.C. that says there are no resources. It is about choices. And every choice we make to do something is a choice we make not to do something else. And so if they want to make the choices, then we should at least hold them accountable. But we shouldn't buy the line that there are not the resources to do the things necessary to end this epidemic, because that's bullcrap, and we shouldn't accept it. Last night, we did a forum of and for black gay men to talk about the new incidence data. And I think the most important message that came out of that forum is the need to build and to continue to build community and to address culture. That we need to decide what is acceptable in our culture. You know, is it acceptable that on the richest country in the world, that we have people who are dying or people who don't have access to treatment that they need? That should not be the culture that we find acceptable, and we should stand up against that. Is it acceptable that we decide that there are people who are valued and people that are not? We should not allow that to be our culture. We need to make sure that we are bringing everybody along in our process. And that's the culture we should speak up to. As we move forward, you know, it's also important that we build the infrastructure and capacity in the AIDS epidemic. And as we talk about the new paradigm of HIV, we need to make sure that there are institutions that serve the people most at risk. And I'll leave you with this. It's a saying that, a phrase that I've been using for nearly 30 years now. And if any of you have ever heard me speak, you've heard me say it. And that is, the day will come when this epidemic will be over. And when it does, it's important for them to know that we were not all monsters, that we were not all cowards, that some of us dared to care in the face of it. Some of us dared to fight because of it. And some of us dare to love in spite of it, because it is in the caring and the fighting and the loving that we live forever. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Phil, for those extremely important and fiery comments. I think you really got the audience fired up. And ready for Dr. Marjorie Hill, the Executive Director of GMHC.
Thanks,
Marjorie.
Boy. So thank all of you who haven't jumped on a plane and who are anxiously watching your watches instead of the screen. I'm going to try to keep to the five-minute timeline. This is an incredible opportunity and pretty awesome to be the last speaker. And George, wherever you are, I don't know why you made me nervous. I was fine until you told me you were nervous. But one of the good things about being here is and working in the field is I'm not alone. I'm not alone in my life, and I'm not alone on this stage. I'm so honored to have the opportunity to speak today, and in particular speak with, following as it should be, two really incredible individuals who have proudly lived with and talked about and been out about their status, and in that have saved tremendous lives. So I just want to acknowledge both Michelle and Phil. I really want to talk a little bit about social justice public health and its role in highly impact prevention. Okay. So lots of HIV tells us that we need to talk. What we've learned through HIV is we need to talk about ourselves, that the telling of our stories is empowering. I learned something about Willow the other day. And I have on my NAPWA earrings. I just want to acknowledge the women of NAPWA. When I was in second grade, I was bused to a predominantly white school in Queens. And at the end of my first day, I came home and my mother said to me, "How was it?" I said, "Mom," I was so excited, "it was great. They were out there with signs, and they were clapping and making noise when we got off the bus. It was like a parade." On July 24th, the state of New York became the sixth state to make same-sex relationships legal. That's actually an illegal picture, but we're working on it. So racism, AIDS, what does that have to do with advocacy? On August 11th, 1981, in Larry Kramer's living room, the world changed forever. On that Tuesday, 30 years ago, a group of men decided to choose fighting as opposed to choosing fear and helplessness. They passed the hat, $7,000 was raised, and GMHC was born. Advocacy from the living room. Whoops. When GMHC opened, our clients were mostly white gay men, many who died within the first 3 to 6 months that they sought out connection to us because there was no treatment. We helped our clients die with dignity. And the advocacy was hospital respect and funeral home burials. In our brand new home, you've heard GMHC move, right? In our brand new home, where we've been at the last 15 weeks, 44% of our new intakes are African American, 35% of our new clients are Latino, and 25% of our new clients are over 50. We now help our clients live with dignity. Housing support, eviction prevention, financial management, benefit advocacy, vocational assessment, job training. Workforce equals better labs. In the early days, clients, staff, volunteers, donors, and sometimes those were the same people, all took to the streets. Today, the GMHC Action Center in our newly expanded dedicated room with phone banking possibilities and Wi-Fi, client-organized, client-led advocacy makes strategic opportunities to meet with legislators, to influence policy, and to raise hell. We've spent the past 4 days and a lot this morning talking about the many reinforcement messages and painful reminders of how much advocacy is needed. With a stable epidemic, gay men, especially young black gay men, have been disproportionately impacted with an HIV/AIDS burden. But this is not just a gay problem. Coretta Scott King once said that homophobia is probably one of the greatest determinants and challenges of HIV for black women. And she wasn't talking about gay men infecting black women. She was talking about that because black women and the black community believed it was a gay issue, that it took the community a little longer. Much of the success of Phil's work is challenging that. But we know what we need to do and what we need to advocate for. And again, the last 4 days, I've heard this that has both been a good message to hear because it's true, but hard. Gender inequities, transphobia, social determinants, poverty, all of these are drivers of the epidemics. So we know what we need to do. What have Americans learned about HIV in these 30 years? Not enough. I hate to read the slide, but I just have to say, in 1985, 44% of people thought that you could catch HIV through drinking a glass. In 2011, 25%, according to Kaiser. We have much more we need to do. So we know what we need to do, and we know where we need to go, whether it is to talk to our friends and challenge others who are in government. We know that we need to go to faith institutions and work within those communities. And GMHC's 21st House of Latex, that is how I actually broke my toe. I was practicing voguing. And since Phil and I are the same age, I should know better. But whether it's at the House of Latex, the House of Worship, or the House of Legislature, we know where to go. We know where to go. But do we know how to go? And this is the main point that I want to make. When one of us, any one of us, is maliciously maligned, its challenge is lied upon, and we say nothing, how then can we go and advocate together? If Phil Wilson is attacked, if Michelle Lopez is attacked, if Marjorie Hill is attacked, or any of us are, it's our responsibility as a community to stand together. Or we can challenge the government. We can support each other when we are challenging the CDC and HRSA and SAMHSA. But if we're really going to make a difference in the epidemic, we have to learn and repeat the lessons of the earlier years. When I came out, it didn't really matter, you know, whether you were black or white or gay or straight. We all went to the ACT UP demonstrations. Now, I didn't die in because I wasn't getting my clothes dirty. But we all went. And we all supported each other. Audre Lorde taught us that our silence will not protect us. And if we talk to the same people, then what are we going to do? So if we talk to the folks who look like us, who think like us, who like the same music and eat the same foods, we're going to have a good time, but we will not achieve high-impact advocacy. Some of our partners there are, the picture there is, we have a campaign, a First Ladies campaign, and that's the First Lady of First Baptist Church of Crown Heights. And that's a fan. And we had these fans at church, and you know how the funeral homes, well, some of you may know, but in Baptist churches, the funeral homes support the church's fans. Well, what we did is we went to First Baptist and we said we would like the First Lady to have her picture on this fan. And on the back it says, Mrs. Norman encourages you to get tested. And whether you go to the health department or GMHC or to your private doctor, you should get tested. AARP, you know, the workforce program, I got it, all right. The National Hemophilia Association. We cannot just work with the people who we know and the people who we get along with. In the beginning, we needed resources. We created traditions like AIDS Walk, like AIDS Ride. But at the end of the day, the messages that we need to get out there are that we count, that all of us count, and we can't have any of our constituencies dissing each other. Black gay men do and need to support Latina women. Asian Pacific Islanders need to support Latina lesbians. Trans people need to be included in all our communities. We will not be successful until we learn how to advocate together. Actually, I want to say we already know that lesson. We have seen what happens when we don't do that lesson. All we have to do now is to remember. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marjorie, for those kind words. I just want to remind everyone, not only has GMHC been important because of its historical profile in the epidemic, but I think it's been a real example of how community-based organizations can change and evolve in terms of not just the clients they serve, but the structures and supervisory and leadership positions. So keep up the great work. I just wanted to make a few very brief closing comments before we end our meeting. That's correct, isn't it, Dr. Walitsky? And then who comes up after me? You can see how flexible we are up here. Let me begin by congratulating CDC and their many partners for an extremely successful meeting. I'd like to specifically congratulate the co-chairs of the meeting, Kevin Fenton, Deborah Parham Hobson, Jonathan Merman, Mario Perez, and Rich Walitsky. All of the, let's have a round of applause. All of the track chairs, co-chairs, people who submitted abstracts, volunteers, all of the CDC staff, and certainly last but not least, all of you who attended the meeting. It's especially gratifying for me, for the young people in the audience probably don't know this, but for the first time that this meeting was held, the first four times of this meeting, I was at CDC then, and I was the chair of the meeting. So in 1999, which was the first national HIV prevention meeting, in 2001, 2003, and 2005, I worked with a dedicated team of professionals from CDC and other federal agencies. So it's great to see that the meeting is thriving and continuing to grow, and congratulations. And, you know, the meeting is successful for a number of reasons, not just because of the quality of the information that's provided, and there was a lot of high-quality information provided, but also the breadth of issues. When we first started this meeting in 1999, frankly, many folks said, well, why, just a meeting just on prevention? Isn't that a little focal? But I think you can see that through the prevention lens, we can really look at the entire world and spectrum of issues and services. So I think the breadth of issues presented is extremely impressive as well. And finally, I want to say that I think the meeting is successful because it's really provided an opportunity, a positive environment where we can come together and share different perspectives. It's clear that there are areas where we collectively we're not all on quite the same page, and it's important that we work through those. Whether we're talking about funding announcements or how we target resources to populations, it's important that we hear those, we collectively hear those issues, talk about those issues, have a space where we can work through the many complexities and get out to the other end where we can get back to providing services and doing the research and developing the policies that we need to reduce HIV infections in this country. So I think for all of those reasons, it's been an extremely successful meeting. I was also asked, before you push me off the podium, Rich, to make a few brief comments about moving forward. And I do that wearing my HHS hat and in the role of the person who works with colleagues across HHS to implement the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. And I just want to make four or five very brief points about that from my perspective about how we move forward. I think we heard from all three of our panelists in their own inimitable ways the importance of family. And without sounding corny or maudlin, we are a family. And like all families, sometimes we fall out with one another. Some days we get along better with one another. But it's very important that we keep talking to one another and keep sharing our perspectives because, yes, we all tend to look at this in different ways depending upon where we work and live and the experiences we've been through. So let's just remember that I think we all want the same thing here. Doesn't mean we always agree about how to get there, but we need to remember we all want the same thing. And that thing is the vision of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, that we really do want to get to a day in the United States where HIV infection is a very rare condition. And when people do become infected, they get diagnosed promptly and they get referred into high-quality care, and we don't have to deal with the stigma and the other issues that impede people living healthy lives. So that's the first point I want to say. The second point I want to say, there's been a lot of discussion throughout the meeting about resources, and that hasn't changed in 30 years. Maybe some of the specific numbers have changed, but it's clear that we all, no matter where we come from, we all deal with and grapple with the issue of unmet needs, whether we're talking about ADAP waiting lists or funding for community-based organizations or having enough resources to staff state and local health departments, the ways that they need to be staffed to do their job. So I definitely love what Phil said about the importance of continuing to share messages with policymakers about the need for resource, I would also say to all of us, we have to start doing a better job sharing resources. Doesn't mean we stop talking about unmet need, but we really have to use, as they used to say in my day, you got to use what you have to get what you want. So we have to do a better job of sharing resources. And yes, that will, in some instances, entail redirection. That redirection will be geographic. That redirection will also be in the ways that we implement those resources. That's why you've heard so much about scale at this meeting. So I will say that we all recognize we have to redirect, but my plea to everyone in this room is that we think very carefully about when we redirect, we understand the impact of the redirection, and we plan for that impact. Because, again, the goal is we all want to be on the same side of the page here. We all want to get to a point where we're reducing new infections, we're getting people diagnosed and into care, and we're addressing the health inequities that our first panel talked about this morning. I want to say that we have to use data more wisely. And I thought Tiffany and other people, David Holtgrave, other people at this meeting, have done a fantastic job talking about how we use data to make better decisions that serve our clients. It's great to publish papers. I've published a few in my day myself, but that's not the primary reason that we collect data. CDC will tell you that surveillance is data for public health action. And I think we heard a lot about that at this meeting. We have to use data more wisely. And federal agencies, you've heard me say this once, I'm going to say it again from the podium. Part of that means we have to start asking for information in ways that are consistent across our agencies. We cannot have CDC asking for data one way, HRSA asking yet another way, SAMHSA asking a third way. And it also means, like it or not, we have to be reasonable about the number of data elements we ask for from our grantees. We definitely have to do that, and there were a couple of sessions at this meeting that talked about steps that are going to be taken in that regard. I think we need to continue to communicate even when we don't agree, and I think, as I said earlier, this meeting has done a great job of allowing that to happen. And then this is my final point. This is the 30-year anniversary of the first report of what we now know as AIDS. Everyone has shared their personal stories. I don't typically get into personal details, but I will say this on the last point. I lost my twin brother Edwin to AIDS in 1992, and he was the dearest person to my heart in the world then and now. And I will end by saying to all of you, as Phil and Michelle and Marjorie said, as Rich said, the struggle is not over, so we have to stay strong. And I don't know what you do, but I know when I get tired, I think about my angels in heaven, and my brother Edwin is one of them. So I just want to say on that note, thank you all for a wonderful meeting, and keep up the great work.
So, before we end the meeting, I want to thank Ron, Phil, Marjorie, and Michelle again for a wonderful panel, and invite Dr. Fenton and my fellow co-chairs to join me on the podium.
Hi, everyone. At the end, behind any great meeting is just great colleagues that have made this meeting such a great success. I'd like to thank the panelists this morning, but there's some specific people who've been working behind the scenes to really help us to navigate the past 4 days and to ensure that everything ran on time, that we got to where we needed to be, that you enjoyed the food, the rooms, as well as the scientific and programmatic discussions that we had. I'd like to thank NIH and SAMHSA for providing funding support for this conference, for HRSA for their assistance in planning, for the Office of National AIDS Policy and the Office of HIV/AIDS Prevention and the Office of Women's Health for partnering with us on this conference, for NMAC for taking care of the registration process, for Team PSA for providing logistical support for the conference, especially Lushan Norris and her staff, as well as Michael Freeman, who ensured that all of our AV needs were met. I'd also like to add my thanks to the CDC staff who really worked behind the scenes to make this all possible. To Bob Komischer, our excellent conference coordinator. And Mary Brown, who was the conference co-coordinator. Finally, to our stellar conference scientific and steering committees, the track chairs, who did so much work to pull together this amazing conference for all of us. And most especially to my dear friends and conference co-chairs, Rich Wolitzki, John Merman, Deborah Parham-Hobson, and of course, Mario, who's not here, he had to catch a flight. So please join me in thanking our co-chairs. And finally, I'd like to thank all of you for your leadership and your unwavering support and your unwavering dedication in the fight against HIV. As you've heard throughout the course of this conference, and as you've definitely heard this at this closing plenary, we cannot do this alone. We need each other for the journey ahead. We have had a chance to reflect on the first 30 years of this epidemic. I hope that by participating in this conference, you are re-energized, you are retooled, and you are re-inspired for the fight ahead. Thank you so much for attending. Safe journey home.